Thank you very, very much, Sir Bhadramati, for a very generous introduction. And yes, welcome everybody. Welcome to our Mandala evening. Welcome to 2016. I like to think that this is where 2016 begins at the LBC. So very, very warm welcome. Lovely to see you. And although I can't see you in the room next door, welcome to you too. So, yes, I want to start this talk by introducing you to a theme that we're going to have for the next 4 years at the LBC. So we've often had themes that run for a number of years. And for the next 4 years, we're going to be looking at a particular set of teachings called the Four Sangravastus, which many of you will be familiar with. Some of you will not be familiar with them, and I'm not going to say a great deal about them at the moment. You'll hear more about them as the year unfolds and as the years unfold. But the Sangravastus, what I will say, are a set of teachings about the creation of Sangha, about what it means and how we create Sangha, how we create community. And it feels to me, increasingly feels to me that the Dharma life is lived in order to create Sangha. That's how it feels. It certainly wouldn't be what I would have said when I was ordained 17 years ago. It certainly wouldn't have been what I would have said when I first walked into this centre over 20 years ago. At the time, I thought that the Dharma life was all about me getting enlightened, and the sooner the better, and then I'd be happy, and I don't know about anybody else, but I'd have got my money's worth, if you see what I mean. And increasingly, as I practice and as I understand Bhante Sangharakshita's teaching more, as I see something of the wondrous nature of the Dharma more, and as I get older, I feel slightly differently. Not that the Dharma isn't about attainment of enlightenment. That transcendent goal is central and crucial, and I'm going to come back to that transcendent goal later on in the talk. Without that transcendent goal, Sangha just degenerates into not a spiritual community, but a group, positively, possibly healthy, but nothing more than a bunch of well-meaning individuals. So the transcendent ideal of enlightenment is absolutely key, but somehow it's not enough. At least it's not enough if enlightenment means individual liberation. If that's what it means, then that, for me, and for Sangharakshita, isn't enough. Sangha is, you could say, a bigger ideal. It's a broader ideal. It's a vision of a whole world living in harmony, orientating their lives to that transcendent ideal, in fellowship with each other. That vision, which is Sangharakshita's vision, is much, much bigger. It's much, much bigger. And the vision of the LBC is that vision, albeit we do it at the moment in a tiny, 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 tiny way. This community here is a microcosm. At its best, it's a microcosm of the ideal of Sangha. And, of course, fortunately, we're part of a worldwide movement which extends that idea much further. And fortunately, we're not the only people practicing Sangha or trying to build Sangha. But nevertheless, at our best, I feel, like Sir Bhadramati, very privileged to be part of a community, a living spiritual community. And increasingly, as I say, that is what makes life feel worthwhile. That's what I think I am trying to live for. So the Sangravastus are a set of teachings. They're four teachings about how a bodhisattva would create Sangha, how a bodhisattva, a realized being, would create Sangha. And each year we're going to be introducing one of those teachings. And the first means of the creation of Sangha for a Bodhisattva is dana, or generosity. Dana, or generosity. And it's that that I'm going to primarily talk about. But I just want to say one more thing about Sangha, and I'll probably touch on it again. It feels to me not just personally important. I've said that it is increasingly what I see as the paramount ideal life. But it's not just personally important. It seems to me, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, that the world needs examples of spiritual communities more than perhaps it's ever needed. The world needs examples of community living for an ideal, people living for an ideal that is bigger than individual personal gain or happiness. When you look at the state of the world, when you look at the state of a lot of people in the world, it feels like we're creating at times a mad and madder world around us. And we seem to be doing that sort of individually and collectively for want of some sort of ideal, some sort of better way of living. And when we create Sangha, even if we can only do it in a very, very small way, when we create just a glimpse of Sangha, you could say, what we're also doing is holding a lamp up to the darkness. We're holding up an ideal, a living ideal, as an exemplification of what the world could be. So yes, the first of the Sanghavastus, the first means of creating Sangha for a Bodhisattva, is generosity or dana. And that's what I want to talk about in the remainder of the talk primarily. But as way of introducing the topic of dana or generosity, I was reflecting on a classic formulation of the path to enlightenment, which is the threefold path. The threefold path, familiar to most of us, will be ethics, meditation, and wisdom, or sila, samadhi, prajna. Sila, samadhi, prajna. Ethics, meditation, and wisdom. This is a path, a model of the path that the Buddha seems to have taught again and again, particularly when you read a sutta called the Parinibbana Sutta, which talks about the Buddha's last days on earth, his last living days. He wanders from village to village, town to town, teaching this very, very principal, fundamental teaching of the path to enlightenment being sila, samadhi, prajna, ethics, meditation, and wisdom, each building on the other, with a foundation of an ethical life, we are more able to become absorbed in meditation. If our conscience isn't clear, if our mind isn't pure, higher meditative states are very unlikely to arise, and if they do, they can't be stabilized. Without ethics, meditation is a potluck, chancy endeavor that won't really lead to systematic growth. But meditation itself isn't enough. It's not the goal of the Dharma life. Meditation can produce higher mental states. It can produce a happier, healthier, more positive mind. But that too is ephemeral. It's transient. It's not the goal of the Dharma life. The Buddha taught us a transcendent ideal, which has to be realized, each of us, for ourselves, on the basis of an absorbed, positive, concentrated, creative mind. We can realize this wisdom that transcends all conceptual constructions. We can directly experience the nature of consciousness, the nature of life, the nature of everything, directly for ourselves. And when that happens, it's an overturning of everything that we've known. Everything that we've assumed is turned around, and there's a liberation that cannot be reversed. It cannot be contained. And it's a liberation that transcends the very notion of death, of life and death. It's a transcendent ideal. And that's prajna. So you've got sila, samadhi, prajna as this classic path that all of us who are Buddhists are trying to tread, albeit probably not in that systematic way, probably not in that linear way. But one of the things Bhante Sangharakshita says is that sometimes there's a fourth step to the path. Actually, there's a first step that precedes even sila, that precedes even ethics, and that is dana, generosity. What he says is that you could think of the path in terms of four stages: dana, sila, samadhi, prajna. If you can't practice wisdom, and you can't practice meditation, and you're not even able to practice Buddhist ethics, what he says is, well, what you can do is give, be generous, be generous. And if you can be generous, the whole of the path opens up. He talks about dana as being the basic Buddhist virtue. In his lecture on the Noble Eightfold Path on perfect emotion, he talks about dana as being the basic Buddhist virtue without which you can hardly call yourself a Buddhist. And generosity is something that we can all practice. We can all practice, no matter how much money we think we have or don't have. It's not about what we can give so much as a state of mind, an open-heartedness, a willingness to give. So yes, dana, sila, samadhi, prajna. So I was thinking about that, and then I was thinking, well, actually, it feels to me like you could have a five-fold path, a five-stage path. And this is now, I'm straying off piece. So this is, as far as I know, it's not Sangharakshita or the Buddha, it's just me. So you have to take it with a pinch of salt, perhaps, but it seems to make sense. So I was thinking that a five-fold path would be dana, sila, samadhi, prajna, dana. That's how it should be. That's how it should be. Because once somebody has glimpsed the truth of enlightenment, even if it's just the tiniest glimpse, what it should do, if it's a genuine taste of wisdom, is it should open the heart, it should break open the heart so that you want to serve and give. Wherever you can, you want to serve and give, because there's an abundance of gratitude and love that just overflows. If that doesn't happen, you're probably right to doubt whether it's genuine prajna that you've glimpsed. So it seems to me it's dana, sila, samadhi, prajna, dana. And then I was thinking, I just got carried away, I'm afraid, that actually it could be a sevenfold path. And that's the path that I want to talk about. And I think the sevenfold path is dana, sila, dana, samadhi, dana, prajna, dana. It's a path of generosity at higher and higher levels. It is the spiral path with generosity as its underpinning. It's a path of dana. So that's what I want to try and outline for you. So let's start with dana, the first stage of dana, at the beginning of the path. Generosity as we can all experience it. One of the things about generosity, and it's true at all levels, but I think particularly it's important at this level, is that overcomes isolation. It overcomes this sense that I'm a lone individual in a mad world that's against me somehow. It immediately starts to create connection. And as soon as there's connection, even if it's between two people, you've got the birth of Sangha. You've got the Sangha in embryonic form. It starts to help us feel like we're together, that we're not alone, that there is a sense of connection, even empathy, with another human being. It's very, very simple. Just a simple act of kindness, particularly if it's generosity, can create connection. I was reading about some thing in America where they've got Heavenly Donuts, a chain. Heavenly Donuts. And there was a driver who bought his donuts. It was a drive-through, and he bought his donuts. You might have heard about this. And he bought his donuts, and then he paid for the donuts in the car behind. And it was a woman in the car behind, and she was having a bit of a bad day. And the donuts, she couldn't really afford treats like donuts, but she was having a bad day, and she'd stopped to buy donuts. And when she got to pay for them, they were already paid for. And she decided not just to receive the gift, which she did, but then she paid for the donuts in the car behind. And apparently this went on. The car behind paid for the car behind, and the car behind. And all day that continued, when nobody paid for their own donuts. And everybody received a gift. Isn't that fantastic? Just a tiny, tiny. And what a world that would be if donuts were free. What a world. The Buddha talks of, not the Buddha, but the later teaching in Buddhism is about how a bodhisattva or a Buddha creates a pure land. And in a pure land, yeah, you guessed it, the donuts are free all the time. And everything in a pure land leads to, teaches of enlightenment. Everything speaks of enlightenment. And mythically, you could say that we're in a pure land. This project of the London Buddhist Centre was always inspired by that myth of creating a pure land, a heaven on earth, you could say, a pure land where everything speaks of the nature of enlightenment, the nature of liberation. And a pure land isn't created by buildings and beautiful shrines, although they are needed. A pure land is created by living beings. It's created by us. It's created by practitioners moving towards this ideal of self-transcendence. Enough of us doing that creates a world. And that's what this place is. We're trying to create a world. Some of us have recently been on retreat. And on retreat, you can really glimpse what it would be like to live in a pure land. To live in a pure land. So yes, giving at this first level, I just want to talk about that in terms of overcoming isolation. Perhaps it's particularly important in London and at a centre the size of the LBC where our Sangha is large. I mean, it could be a lot larger, and I'm hoping it becomes even larger. But for as Buddhist centres go, it's a large Sangha. And one of the consequences of a large Sangha, I felt this when I first came along, is that it can feel rather impersonal. It can take time for you to get to know people. And it can take even longer before you feel you've got friends in the Sangha. For about a year, I used to come in and sort of hang out around the bookshop, hoping nobody spoke to me, because I didn't want to be spoken to, at the same time feeling rather isolated and alien. And I don't think anybody kind of noticed. If you were in a smaller centre, in a smaller Tree Ratna centre, you would be noticed. So one of the ways to overcome that, if you want to feel part of the Sangha and you don't yet feel part enough, then give. Just give. Come and help. There's always something to do at the center. Come and help. If you haven't got time, or even if you have got time, see if you can spare some money. Give some money. If you can support a class of an evening, if you're coming to a class regularly, well, come and just support the class and make tea or be hospitable, welcome people on the door, etc. If you just start to participate in small or large ways, the Sangha becomes your own. You become part of the Sangha. The community is formed through generosity. That's how it's formed. Sometimes when you first walk through the doors, if you first walk through the doors tonight, it can feel like this is a sort of place where you get things. And you might give some money, but it can feel like, yes, in return, you get some meditation teaching and some Dharma teaching. But that is the consumerist model. That's not what we're about. This whole place is built on the ideal of generosity. No one here is paid, including myself, including Subhadramati, including any of the teachers. We give on the basis of generosity, and then we're supported so that we can carry on giving. So our needs are met in order to carry on giving. And that's the way everything works. Everybody here is a volunteer of some sort or other. This sense of giving, creating connection was brought home to me very early on in my order life. I'd just been ordained, in fact. I was ordained in India 17 years ago, and I had been ordained a matter of days, and I found myself on a convention, which was a gathering of order members, maybe about 200, 250 Indian order members, a few Westerners, including, well, me, who was a bit of a hybrid, and I didn't really know what was happening. Everybody seemed to want to talk to me. I couldn't speak Marathi or Hindi, and many of them couldn't speak English, but they would want to talk to me anyway. And that's quite a bizarre thing when you get taken for a walk. People hold your hand and they talk. And you don't know what they're saying, but you smile. And it seems that connections are formed. But I met somebody who did speak English, and he said, "What do you do, Jnanavacha?" And he meant, "What do I do for work?" And I'd started working at the Buddhist Center here for about a year, and I was fundraiser. And I was trying to raise money for Vajrasana. And you may think that's taken a long time. But this, 17 years ago, was the first Vajrasana. It was the first incarnation of Vajrasana. And it went very well, actually. The fundraising went very well. It went well enough. And we bought somewhere. And then when I became chairman, we decided to knock it down and start again. And, of course, we're now in the closing months of this wonderful project that will, I think, really deepen our sense of Sangha. Not just deepen, but extend our sense of Sangha. Maybe I'll say a little bit more about that anyway, later. But Viveka Bhadra, this order member that I met in India, he was intrigued that I was fundraising for a retreat centre for the London Buddhist Centre. He'd heard of the London Buddhist Centre. The London Buddhist Centre has a real spiritual significance in the heart of the Triratna community. Wherever you are, the London Buddhist Centre is the most established centre, and for that reason, and Sangharakshita lived here for many years, and for that reason, it has a particular resonance in the heart of the order. And he said he wanted to give to Vajrasana, to the fundraising. And I sort of immediately thought, well, I think I said no. That's not what I was fundraising for. I was somehow just taken aback. I didn't want him to be put out in any way. And he said, no, I want to give. I want to give. And I said, why do you want to give, Viveka Bhadra? And he said, well, there are three reasons. The first is, I'm a Buddhist, and that's what Buddhists do. They give. And I'd read about Sangharakshita saying that dana was the basic Buddhist virtue, but here I really saw it in action. And he said the second reason is that I feel a connection with you. I don't know if I'll ever see you again. I want to give because you're fundraising, and that will deepen our connection. And then he said the third reason is, he said, I will probably never go to Vajrasana. I'll never see that retreat centre. I haven't told him we've knocked it down. I'll never see that retreat centre, but I want to feel a connection with the people in London who are practising at that retreat centre. And he said, so please say yes, I will give. And I will give 60 rupees a month, which was the equivalent of about £1, for a year. And he was a pretty poor man. So 60 rupees a month was going to actually be felt by him. And he did. He set up a way of giving for 60 rupees a month. When I think of Vajrasana, I really do think it, and I think of the LBC, it has been acts of generosity. People like Viveka Bhadra and hundreds, maybe thousands of other people have built what we've got today and are building it further. I think it's really important that we live in a way that bucks the trend of this consumer mentality, where you part with money in order to get something in return. Today is, I'm told, Blue Monday. Do you know about Blue Monday? It was an invention, apparently, by a holiday company in 2005. So it's not real, but then nothing is real. Blue Monday is supposed to be the most depressing day of the year. The most depressed day of the year. And well done, you're here. You've survived the day so far. And it's said to be depressing because, I don't know, they worked out all the sorts of factors involved in what makes people happy. And today doesn't work, apparently. I feel fine, by the way. But it's Blue Monday. But I was reading about Blue Monday. Maitra Bandhu pointed it out that it was Blue Monday. I thought it was Black Monday, but he said it was blue. And apparently Tesco's, that sort of epitome of consumerist society, is giving away free food, or was giving away free food today on Blue Monday. And I thought, oh, well, that's lovely, isn't it? And that's probably what you're meant to think. I know. The cynic in me knows that it's probably a marketing thing, etc. But I think, that's just lovely. That's just lovely. Giving away free food. I nearly went down there, but I was trying to write this talk. See if they had some donuts. But generosity, dana, isn't just charity. It's not quite the same thing. One of the things Bhante says is that dana is defined in terms of the wanting, the feeling of wanting to give. Now, charity might or might not have that generous spirit behind it. It might do, but it might not. Camus said, too many have dispensed with generosity in order to practice charity. And I'm not knocking charity, but what I'm saying is that generosity, dana, has to stem from a state of mind and heart. Charity, you've got many rich people giving money to charity, and I don't know whether it stems from generosity or whether it's absolving guilt, or there might be all sorts of motivations. It might be generous. There are very generous philanthropists who give away millions, billions in the case of some of them. But it's not necessarily dana. It's not necessarily dana. You have to look at your motivation. If for it to be dana, it has to be this open-heartedness. Talking of rich philanthropists, I was reading that Oxfam have just published a report. Have you read this? That 62 of the world's richest people, the 62 of the world's richest people, who are all billionaires, multi-billionaires, now have as much wealth as the poorest half of the world. The poorest 50% of the world, and that's something like 3.7 billion people, own as much as 62 people. Yeah? And we wonder why the world is such a mad place. That is the antithesis, it seems to me, of the Buddhist ideal of Sangha, of the Pure Land. So in a way, this brings me on to the next point, that dana giving might be dana, but really to be on the spiritual path, you've also got to be practicing sila. So, for example, if you were a rich businessman, earning your money in unscrupulous ways and then giving away a portion of it to charity, in a way, you're treading a fine line between generosity and hypocrisy. I've seen it in Hindu culture. You've got very rich people sometimes giving to charity, but actually it doesn't seem to me from an open-hearted empathy with the world. It's from other sorts of mixed motives. So sila protects us or purifies the motivation. It really is then about trying to live according to the values that we are espousing. It's we need to be aligning our behaviour with our values. Only if we're then doing that is our dana, I think, starting to become real dana. So then that's why I've said that there's dana, then there's sila, and then there's dana again. There's dana again that comes from an alignment of our values with our behaviour, our behaviour with our values. But then sila alone isn't enough. It's not enough. Ethics alone isn't enough. In Buddhism, ethics is a means, not an end in itself. Beautiful though virtuous actions are, they're not an end in themselves. They're a means to greater and greater states of liberation and greater states of, well, generosity, you could say. Because sila, as an end in itself, can become self-referential and moralistic. Even good behaviour patterns, we can start to become rather tight about. What comes to mind is sometimes it's people who are trying to do good in the world, but they're doing it out of righteous indignation and anger. You know about, I won't go into it, but you can imagine the sort of protesters for good causes, animal rights, for example, who are doing it out of anger. And in a way, if you're doing it out of anger, you're adding to the sum total of hatred in the world. I think as Buddhists, we should all be moving towards vegetarianism, if not veganism. But not out of righteous indignation or moralism or condemnation of others who aren't vegetarian or vegan. It has to be from a positive state of mind. Sila on its own can harden into literalism. Yeah? And if you find that your heart is hardened in any way, then it's not ethics. It's not Buddhist ethics. It's never Buddhist ethics. If it's hardening the heart. So then you need you need to give, and you also need to practice meditation. So there's dana, sila, dana, and then samadhi. Because without meditation, I don't think we really start to work on our minds very directly. Now, meditation isn't the only way of working on one's mind. But it is, it's said to be like the royal road to enlightenment. It really is a way of working on your mind par excellence. And with the aid of meditation, our minds can become, our hearts can become more positive, more open. There's genuine empathy. There's genuine self-awareness. And without self-awareness, we'll not be aware of what really drives us, what motivates us, what fuels us. Is it anger? Is it generosity? Meditation is key to a genuinely aware ethical life. It also helps to counter an anxious response to the problems of the world. You only have to turn on the news or look at the BBC News website or open your paper, and it's anxiety-inducing. It's anxiety-inducing. So much of the news is feels really difficult to let in and stay positive about. There's sort of horrors on personal, individual levels to global levels happening all the time. It seems like it's happening more and more. And we need, if we're going to be effective in setting some sort of creative, positive example, holding up some sort of beacon of light, we need to be coming from a positive state of mind. Not that we turn a blind eye to the horrors of the world, but we need to find a greater creativity and love in our response. And meditation, seems to me, is key to developing that. Go and see Room. I saw Room on Saturday. Have any of you seen it? It's a wonderful, wonderful film about one of the darkest subject matters that you could possibly imagine. I won't tell you much about it. You'd need to see it. It's a sort of grim subject matter of two people. And that is partly because it's told, this very difficult story is told from the perspective of a very positive mind. In the case of this story, it's told from the perspective, from the eyes of a five-year-old boy who seems to be very positive. And whatever seems to happen, he seems to think it's all right. And I'm not saying that childish innocence is some sort of utopian ideal. All I'm using it to illustrate is that we can look at horrors in the world and remain open-hearted. And it's only if we do that and remain creative and remain positive in an optimistic sense that there is the possibility of transcendence. It's only if we do that that we're going to be of any use, yeah, as individuals and as a community. And meditation seems to me key to that. Also, one last thing to say about meditation is that our own selfishness, my selfishness, runs very, 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 very deep. The more I practice, the more I become sobered by the depth and extent of self-centeredness, my self-centeredness. If I had any illusions when I came along that I would swiftly traverse the path to enlightenment, I don't hold those illusions anymore. The self-centeredness in me, and I fear to say I'm not unique, goes very, very, very deep. And you don't know how deep it goes until you start really looking at your own mind through meditation. Fortunately, what also is uncovered through meditation is love and generosity and empathy and freedom and creativity and joy. So you're able to hold unflinchingly the less palatable aspects of your own nature, because there's so much potential and so much, well, actual good in our experience. Let me read you something that Tom Stoppard said. He said that obviously you would give your life for your children, or give them the last biscuit on the plate. It's a subtle difference, isn't there, between... Anyway, that was Tom Stoppard. Obviously, you would give your life for your children or give them the last biscuit on the plate. But to me, the trick in life is to take that sense of generosity between kin, make it apply to the extended family and to your neighbour, your village, and beyond. That same sense of love that you would have if you were a parent towards your child, that's what the Buddha taught. That sense of love and generosity is fantastic, and the Buddhist ideal is to extend that to all beings. All beings. But I don't think samadhi or meditation, samadhi is absorbed higher states of meditative awareness. Samadhi isn't enough. I think that samadhi, and this is now a particularly Buddhist danger, it doesn't seem to apply to non-Buddhists or non-practitioners, probably because they don't meditate. One of the dangers of being a Buddhist is that particularly if you're fortunate enough to enjoy the bliss that can arise in samadhi, is that you can become complacent. You can think, this is real happiness, true happiness, and I've got it sorted. I've got it sorted. I've now arrived. I can, through samadhi, life does become easier. I really, really want to stress the benefits of samadhi. It's joyous, it's blissful. And what it does is it creates a mind which can meet the ups and downs of life with positivity. And then life becomes easier. Not that everything always works out, but whatever happens, you can meet it with more and more equanimity, positivity, love, perspective, freedom. The danger is that you can think, I've got it sorted, and I'll settle down now to a comfortable, happy life. And I'm afraid you see this amongst Buddhist practitioners, even in Tri Ratna, even in the order. After some decades of practice, it's very tempting to settle down, particularly if you're middle-aged like me, particularly if you like sweet things and lions and all of those things. It's very easy, very, very tempting to think, this is great. I've done it. I'll settle down and put my feet up. And this is why we need to then practice dana. At every stage of any hint of complacency, the way out of a limited success, of a limited ideal, is dana. It is always giving. That's what liberates us from any limited, even if it's a very positive, limited state. Otherwise, I'm afraid samadhi and Buddhism just becomes refined selfishness. And that, to me, feels even worse than crude selfishness. Because crude selfishness, one can sometimes, I can feel, okay, well, people haven't encountered the Dharma yet. If you haven't encountered the teachings of the Buddha, maybe you don't know any better. Maybe you don't know that generosity makes you happy and free and creates a better world for others. But if you have encountered the teachings of the Buddha and have tasted the bliss of samadhi, it seems that to settle for a refined selfishness is really, really sad. And, I don't know, just criminal, really. It just feels really tragic to me to encounter the Dharma and then not pursue it to the end. So dana needs to, in a way, complement ideally come out of the fruits of samadhi. It should be an expression of the bliss, because the bliss is so great, you want to share it. You need to share it. sharing the fruits of our practice is part of the fruits of practice. Without that, it's not a fruit. And we need to translate the love and the empathy that we feel in samadhi into action. Otherwise, what use the metta bhavana? What use the fifth stage where you feel love for all beings if in our lives we don't put that into action, if we don't give, if we don't give? And giving needs to start to really change us. If you really have found the Dharma, and I know many of you in this room have, then really look at how much do we give. Because it needs to be commensurate, I think, with how much we value the Dharma. Many, many people say to me, thank you, I feel profoundly grateful for having encountered the Dharma. I feel profoundly grateful to the LBC, to Sangharakshita, to the teachers that they've met here. I feel that they've transformed my life. And I feel very moved when I hear that. It's always a delight to hear that. But then sometimes I'm tempted to say, so give. So give. And don't give just in accordance to what you'd give to go to the cinema. Look at what you feel you've gained and give commensurate to that. Yeah. Ultimately, if we gain enlightenment, we'll want to give our lives completely. Actually, unless we give our lives, we're not going to gain enlightenment. So we will need to give our lives. We'll need to give everything for enlightenment. And enlightenment is the supreme bliss. It is everything, everything that our hearts have ever yearned for. Everything that we have ever wanted and desired. And thought that it would be found in other ways, in donuts and people and houses and cars and holidays. All of that yearning is only met in enlightenment. To do that, we need to let go of everything. It's like the image, I don't know if this is real, but you've heard tell of a monkey trap where there's a sort of box with a hole in it and nuts inside, and the monkey can put his hand into the box and grab the nut, but the hole is too small for the fist, so he can't get the hand out unless he lets go of the nut and opens his hand. And apparently, I don't know if it's apocryphal, it's a good story anyway, monkeys won't let go of the nuts. And they'll be trapped. They'd rather be trapped and lose their lives than let go of the nut and escape. Yeah? And we are in an analogous situation when we hold on to everything that we think will make us happy. We're like these trapped monkeys, in a way prisoners of our own delusion and our own self-centeredness. So yes, through samadhi, dana starts to spring from more positive states of mind. I was very moved to read a first story of a man. I suspect he's not a meditator. I don't know. But his story speaks to me of real love and real empathy. He's a man called Dan Black, and he's a Welshman, and in 2009 he was in a car accident that left him paralysed from the chest down. And in the resulting operation, he also had a stroke. He was in his teens or something. He was a young man, and in the operation, he had a stroke and lost the use of one of his arms, his right arm. So he's paralysed from the chest down and one arm, and He went back to live with his parents, and one of his friends started a fundraising campaign for him because he needed, you know, to receive care around the clock, etc. But also, there was the possibility of some sort of operation, stem cell operation, that might mean that he could walk again. So, but this was expensive, and a friend anyway started raising money for him, and I don't know how much he needed, but £30,000 was raised, a good way towards meeting the costs of this operation, which was abroad, which may have meant, you know, success in, well, walking again. And he's in his 20s by now. And one day his mother shows him an article in the paper, and there's a boy who's been, who was born with some sort of cerebral palsy or something. I'm not quite sure of the condition. Anyway, he was born unable to walk. And for his parents were trying to raise £100,000 for an operation in the States that might make this boy walk. And Dan Black read this article, and this boy was also in a neighbouring village in Wales, and he gave the £30,000 to the funds for this boy, who was able to have the operation, and I believe was able to walk. That sort of act of generosity comes from real empathy, from real love. And I suspect that somebody in that man's position had really had to go deep into himself and reflect about what life was. If you're paralysed from the chest down in your late teens or early 20s, you need to survive. You probably have had to do a lot of reflection. And samadhi is, helping us to really reflect and look on what life is about. So yes, our dana needs to spring from such positivity. That starts to bring me on to prajna, wisdom, the culmination of the path, or at least that's how it is in the threefold path. Because without wisdom, even our most positive acts of giving, even if they spring from samadhi and love and empathy, there is still somewhere the distinction between me and you, self and other, giver and receiver and recipient. There's still a sense that of separation. And that sense of separation is the root delusion that the Buddha plucked out of his own heart on the night that he gained enlightenment. That root delusion is what keeps us trapped. That's the ultimate trap. But it goes very, very deep. It goes so deep that it's in every act of perception, in everything that every act of perception through our senses reveals to us, tells us we're separate. Every act of perception, every time you look at the world, every time you touch the world and use any of your other senses, there's a subtle reinforcement of that delusion that says, I am here in this thing and you are out there in that thing. It's such a common sense notion that we're separate that it's hard to even imagine that it's a delusion. But it is. It is ultimately a delusion. That is not the way things are. And prajna is the realization that it's a delusion in our very bones. It's not an intellectual realization. It's a direct seeing. It's a direct experience that transcends all concepts. When you transcend subject and object, self and other, you've got no way of now talking about your experience. You've got no conceptual framework to use. Prajna doesn't even just transcend self and other. It transcends the very notion of space and time and a real objective world. It transcends every assumption that we have about the nature of reality. And we see that we've got it completely wrong. Completely wrong. And when we see that, there's a deep, deep letting go. There's an open-heartedness that emerges that is the most freeing thing that a person can possibly experience. You only even have to have a glimpse of prajna, a tiny, tiny glimpse of prajna, for it to change you completely. And it's that we need to be working towards. It's a transcendent ideal. Otherwise, we can be happy, healthy, good people, and we'll still die, and there's still suffering. The transcendent ideal unleashes in us a force that cannot be stopped, and death doesn't mean anything in the end, in the face of this transcendent ideal, because life doesn't mean anything, because separation doesn't mean anything, because this body isn't what we think it is, it isn't who we are. This transcendent ideal unleashed upon the world is a force for good in the world. It's a force for good in the world. But I'm going to extend this ideal further. And really, you shouldn't have to. In a certain sense, you shouldn't have to. The reason I have to extend it is because I think that even in our Sangha, in the Triratna Sangha, in the Triratna order, there's a degeneration of this notion of prajna, of wisdom. One of the dangers of this transcendent ideal is that it can be reduced to my experience, as if it's my possession. Hey, I can experience a glimpse, maybe even more than a glimpse, of enlightenment. And somehow I make it mine and add it on to my ego identity. So now I'm an even bigger Buddhist. Yeah? And unfortunately, that sort of thinking it's a trap, and it's prevalent. It's a very subtle trap, because in a certain sense, there is a liberating experience, and yes, it does happen somehow within one's own consciousness. But it's a trap if you appropriate it, or if I appropriate it. And I want to really just say this to all of us who have been practicing for decades. Please, let's not fall into this trap. And so I've added another step to this path, which is dana. Because after prajna, what should arise is giving, is generosity. And the Bodhisattva, his dana is the dana of the Sangravastus that I was starting off this talk with. What a Bodhisattva does, a Bodhisattva who has not just glimpsed prajna, but dwells in prajna, what he or she does with that experience of bliss and liberation is to create sangha. Dana at this stage is not just a virtue, it's a perfection. It's said to be a paramita, a perfection. I won't go into all the paramitas and the technicalities of it. Suffice to say that there are six of them, and they all arise in a bodhisattva. They're practiced by a bodhisattva, and they represent the action of a mind that dwells in wisdom. And dana is the first of them, the first perfection. There are six. There's ethics and patience and meditation and energy and... Well, the last one is prajna again. So somehow, having glimpsed prajna, there's still a perfection of prajna. There's a perfection of wisdom. That's said to be the highest perfection. But I want to share with you a dream that I had some years ago. I've shared it before, and I think it's one of my dreams that I see as a personal teaching, a sort of guiding teaching. I'm dreaming I'm in India, and I'm lying on a bed, and it's early morning, and I'm sleepy, and I'm just having a lie-in. And next to me is this beautiful woman. She's next to me. And I turn to her, and I feel really happy. I'm just lazing around, and there's light pouring in, and I'm radiantly happy. And then I see two little boys, Indian boys. One of them starts sweeping and cleaning, and one of them starts preparing our breakfast. And I just feel this sense of sort of sadness that they have to work while I'm enjoying lying in bed. I guess I could have got up, but I didn't. In the dream, I sort of just felt this sadness. And I turned to this beautiful woman next to me, and I said, isn't it sad that they have to work? And she said, no, it's not work. They don't have to work. They're serving. And then she turned to me again, looked me straight in the eye, and said, Dana Paramita is the highest paramita. You do know that, don't you? And I woke up. She turned the teaching of the paramitas on its head. The tradition is that Prajna Paramita is the highest paramita, and Dana is the first paramita, which is like you're learning, you're still learning. But she'd turned it on its head. She'd said, no, it's the highest paramita. It's what, in a way, is what we call the Buddha's compassion. That's what dana after prajna really is. It's the Buddha's compassion. It's just that I don't like the word compassion. Compassion in English, maha karuna is lovely. Maha karuna sounds just beautiful, the great compassion. But when it's translated into English as compassion, it so easily becomes sentimentalized as a word. And we do not know what maha karuna is. It is not some sort of sentimental pity for others' suffering. It's an outpouring of wisdom and love. We do not know what that looks like. And it would be better to think in terms of generosity. Rather than talk about compassion, let's talk about generosity. Because we do know what generosity looks like, all of us. So let's just try and practice that generosity at higher and higher levels. And collectively, let's try and really create a sangha that is a force for good in the world. Let's unleash this generous spirit, this force of open-heartedness, because the world desperately, desperately needs it. And we have something very, very precious and valuable to offer it. We must give and not rest content to just be happy Buddhists. We cannot afford that. Bhante Sangharakshita, I believe, he's never said this. For me, he is a bodhisattva. He's a living bodhisattva. Not everybody will necessarily agree with that. I know he's a flawed human being, but to me, he's a living bodhisattva. And what he's done is he's created sangha. He's given us the gift of the sangha. He could have just taught the Dharma, and even that would have been an extraordinary gift. His enunciation, his understanding of the sangha is, I think, revolutionary. It's like a new turning of the wheel of the Dharma for the modern world. It's extraordinary. But he hasn't just given us the Dharma. He's created an order and a community. He's created sangha. This that we're experiencing now is Bhante's gift to us. And it feels beholden on me, and I hope that each of you can feel beholden on you to extend that gift. If you feel you've received anything through this community, to extend it to others and to deepen it into yourself and keep practicing. Keep moving up this hierarchy, this path of dana. I think we really need to look at our culture of sangha and culture of generosity more and more closely. Actually, we do fairly well. Like I was talking about Vajrasana being built out of generosity, acts of generosity. It really is wonderful. I think that Tri Ratna can do much more in the world if we had more resources. And it seems to me a crying shame when I look at other religious movements, how much resources they can manage to generate from their communities. It seems to me a crying shame that in Tri Ratna we are often scrabbling around to employ one more helper in the centre, or one more Dharma teacher, or support somebody to go on a retreat. It seems to me almost criminal. One of the cultural changes that we're talking about in our order is to see if each of us could give 10% of our income to Tri Ratna to the Dharma, to just anything, actually. Just give. Just give. If we could give 10%, maybe some of you already are giving 10% or more, but I'm just throwing down this as a bit of a gauntlet, as a bit of a challenge, to see if we could just think in terms of generosity being one of the building blocks of our community culture, building blocks of our lives individually. Certainly that's what Bhante has exemplified, and we are part of a community of hundreds of thousands of people benefiting from his generosity. He's now 90 and he has not stopped giving. As far as I can see, he's never, ever stopped giving. I want to finish by giving him the last words and read from some words of Sangharakshita that are quoted in this book by Ratnakosha on Dana. These words Bhante talks about in the Bodhisattva Ideal series or Bodhisattva Ideal seminar he gave. And I'll finish with these words. It's a story. It's a story, again, going back to India, to 1956. And, it speaks for itself. In 1956, I was invited by the government of India as one of the 57 distinguished Buddhists from the border areas to visit Delhi for the 2,500th Buddha Jayanti celebrations. In the course of our travels, we came to Benares, and one of the other distinguished Buddhists from the border areas, a friend of mine who was a lay Nyingma Pa Buddhist, took me into Benares, that's present-day Varanasi, took me into Benares to see a Tibetan Lama. Not an incarnate Lama, an ordinary monk who was living there to learn Sanskrit. His name was Tenzin Gyaltso. He was over 70. The Dalai Lama had wanted him to start teaching, but he had refused. He told the Dalai Lama that he was far too busy learning. He hadn't finished his studies. So he settled in Benares to study Sanskrit. We found him at a place almost like a typical Hindu ashram. He had a little room at the top, but it was quite bare. He was sitting on the floor with a tin trunk in front of him, which served as his desk and table, with just a little text on it, which he was studying. He was very pleased to see me, and we talked for about an hour. As we rose to depart, he said, "I really must give you something." He looked around the room, but there was absolutely nothing. I could see that he was almost desperate. He had nothing but his mala. So he broke his mala and gave me one bead and said, "Please, take this. I must have said many millions of mantras on it. It's all I have to give you." Thank you.